This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
Mom and Dad Are Fighting is brought to you by BullandBranch.com, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, and more at BullandBranch.com. That's BullandBranch.com. And use the promo code MOMANDDAD. And by Club W, leading the grape-to-glass wine revolution. Answer just 6 simple questions at ClubW.com, and their algorithm will create a palate profile just for you. Get wine directly to your door, perfectly customized to match your taste. For 50% off your first order, go to clubw.com/momanddad. And by the new middle grade novel, The Terrible Two Get Worse, the hilarious sequel to The Terrible Two, which spent more than 10 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for February 4th, 2016, the Better Get a Shotgun edition. I'm Dan Coyce. I'm an editor at Slate and the dad of Lyra, who is 10, and Harper, who is 8.
And I'm Allison Benedict, also an editor at Slate and the mom of Harry, 7, Sam, 5, and Wally, 2.
Hi, Allison.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm finally out of the snow. On today's show, we're talking to New York City OBGYN Gay Rodkey about Zika virus. What is she telling her patients who are concerned about getting pregnant, about traveling, and about the possible spread of the virus to the U.S.? And we'll check in with the new HBO Sesame Street with New York Magazine reporter Jessica Pressler. Plus triumphs and fails, a listener question about daughters and gender norms, and in our Slate Plus segment, Slate Plus guru Gabe Roth himself will come talk to us in his comforting British-y voice about a triumph or fail. But first, New Yorkers, the bad news is that we postponed the live show because of the snowstorm. I was the Chicken Little behind the postponement. Allison thinks I overreacted. Please commence razzing now, Allison.
I mean, the mayor's wife could make it. She presumably has more important things to do than get through the snow and chit-chat with us. But it's fine. No problem.
Allison, my children went back to school today for the first time in 13 days.
I mean, I'm sorry that your
city
is ridiculous. This was our first, I think this was probably our first real fight. Mom and Dad Are Fighting.
Yeah,
real fight.
This was. Yeah. This was our real actual fight.
Genuinely pissed off.
And we didn't even have it on the air. But the good news is that we have rescheduled for February 18th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. We will be joined once again by Charlene McRae, the amazing First Lady of New York City, plus John Cook, the amazing first man of the Cook Benedict household, plus a discussion on making art for kids with some superstars, like superstars, musician Lori Berkner, Caldecott winner Matt De La Pena, Newbery winner Rebecca Stead. So, Brooklynites, book your artisanal free-range babysitter and join us. We promise a super fun Thursday date night. If you bought tickets to the postponed show, you can use them for this one. If not, you can get tickets at slate.com/live. That's February 18th, slate.com/live. Allison, over to you.
Okay, last episode, I guilted you guys about listening to our show but not liking our Facebook page, and it totally worked. We got a lot of likes. So
that was great. Was some great mom guilt.
Okay, so here we go. In an effort to do it again, please like our Facebook page, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. If you don't like our Facebook page, who knows what will happen to me? I might start to think that maybe you actually don't like me, that your refusal to simply press the like button on Facebook is a choice, not an oversight. Why? What is that about? Is it something I said? Is it my vocal fry? I put a lot of thought into this show, and it feels like you don't really think that much about me. Anyway, I don't want to force you to like us on Facebook. I want you to want to like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. Okay, Dan, what's next?
That really worked. I just liked us on Facebook. Great job.
Thank you.
All right, so let's move on to triumphs and fails. I will start. I do kind of feel that my triumph is that our family survived 12 consecutive days with no school, but I'm going to brag a little about a snow-related dad triumph. So, listeners, Allison, Anne, settle down by the fire with a glass of wine and listen to my tale. So as the snow approached 2 weeks ago, I emailed our next-door neighbor, Dave, and I said, Dave, didn't the guy who lived on the other side of you give you a snowblower when he moved to Florida? And Dave said, yeah, but that was like 4 years ago, and I've never even tried to start it. I don't even know if it works. And I was like, well, we have got to get it running. We are going to get 30 inches of snow on Friday. And Dave said, Dan, come on. We're not going to get 30 inches of snow. Anyways, I've got too much work to do anything on this. But hey, if you want to do something, go for it. So, listeners, I went for it. Now, as you may have figured out from listening to the show, I'm not the most traditionally manly man. For example, among many other things, I'm not handy. I'm not good with tools. When Dave and I were setting up a basketball hoop in the driveway, it took us like 3 hours, and we only got it done because my babysitter, Rebecca, came out and explained how things work to us. But if ever there is a time for reinforcing gender norms in a marriage, it's a blizzard. And I knew that I was not going to delegate shoveling to anyone else. I would just do it. So either I was going to have to shovel 30 inches of snow, or I could get this goddamn snowblower working. So I bought a gas can. I bought gas. I bought fuel stabilizer and small engine oil. I gassed this baby up and I pulled the cord and it didn't start. So I went to the hardware store. I got a spark plug wrench. I came back. I took out the spark plug. I cleaned it off. I put it back in and I pulled the cord. It didn't start. So I called several small engine repair places and asked them if they had any appointments available. And right now, if you listen carefully anywhere in Northern Virginia, you can hear their laughter still echoing off the Blue Ridge Mountains. So I went back to the hardware store and I bought a new spark plug and I came home and I changed the spark plugs and I pulled the cord and it didn't start. So Allison, at this point, I thought, okay, I've exhausted my manly abilities, but I have other abilities. For example, I am shameless and also I'm good at the internet. So I posted on Craigslist, I have a snowblower that won't start. You are good with small engines and want money. Come to my house and get it running and I will give you $50. So within an hour, my phone buzzed. A dude named Randy texted me and said he would be there any minute. So at this point, it's getting dark. I set up a lantern in the driveway. Randy sits in my driveway and smokes cigarettes and tinkers and tells me that it's the carburetor. The carburetor is screwed up. I look up carburetor on Wikipedia. Randy has the entire engine of the snowblower in like multiple pieces sitting on my driveway in the dark. I bring him a thermos of hot cocoa because I'm a good host. And after an hour and a half of work, Randy pulls the cord and vroom. So my triumph is that as 30 inches of snow falls over the next 48 hours, I blissfully send it flying all over my yard. While Alia makes stew in the kitchen and cares for our increasingly feral children, I snowblow my sidewalk, Dave's sidewalk, both of our driveways. It's so much fun. While neighbors toil for days to dig themselves out, me and my kids play America's favorite family card game, Ace of Hates, available at aceofhates.com. And Dave comes out to survey his walk, and he says those three little words that every dad wants to hear. You were right. The end. Allison, how about you?
I look forward to attending your funeral when Randy gives the eulogy and retells the story from his perspective.
I made that guy hot cocoa.
It's the beginning of a beautiful friendship. I'm very impressed. Good job. Triumph.
Thanks.
Okay, I have a fail this week. It will not be nearly told in nearly a suspenseful way. But this is one of those fails that I'd really love to hear from listeners on for advice. So I think I've mentioned this before, but Harry really loves football. He's super into it. He loves to watch it. He loves to play it. He loves to read about it and talk about it. And John and I, despite knowing the dangers of the sport and being people who read, have encouraged this love because it makes him happy and it gets him outside and active. And because we can't get him to read other, like we can't get him to read a Harry Potter book or a Percy Jackson book, but we can get him to read a book of football facts or a biography of John Madden or the Wikipedia page on the AFL. So now, no surprise, he really, really wants to play on the town peewee team. And although I know I'm supposed to be totally opposed to this, I'm considering letting him. And I recently was talking to a great neighborhood dad whose son also really loves to play football with the kids on the block. And I said, so are you going to let him play even just flag football while he's young? And he looked at me like I was an alien. Like I had just said, are you going to let your kid like snort peewee coke? But still, I am considering it. And it's not just because he really wants to do it and it brings him joy. I think it could be a positive experience for him at this age. And my standard defense of this thinking is that he won't actually ever be good enough to play in high school when this really becomes dangerous. But I'm not sure if that's a legitimate argument or not. What do you think?
I think you can't make that argument now. You don't know how good he's going to be. And B, by the time he reaches high school, 90% of parents won't let their kids play football. So anyone who will play will get a spot on the team.
Yeah.
This is a really hard decision. So tell me, based on your reading and based on what you know about the Pee Wee League, what are the dangers at this age as opposed to the dangers in high school, for example, where the hits are harder and the game is faster?
Well, I mean, you're overestimating how much research I've done. I mean, I don't even know. All I did was email the lady at the league and ask. I don't even know I doubt it. I mean, I can't imagine that.
Will my kid be concussed in your league?
No, I asked.
Oh.
I asked if they have touch football options or flag football options because the website isn't very clear and it seems like it's all tackle. Maybe she's not writing back because she's like, we got another one from Brooklyn. But yeah, I mean, I think the harder the hits, the more dangerous it is. Clearly,
I mean, it seems to me that if you look hard enough, you can find flag or touch football things that your kid can do. There have got to be some. And if I were you, I would not sign him up for peewee tackle football before you like give it everything you can to find a non-tackle option.
And you don't think flag football is like just a gateway drug to regular football?
It's not as much of a gateway drug as regular football is.
Yeah. Okay.
I want to hear what our listeners have to say.
I mean, yeah, I would like to hear what listeners have to say. I'm not sure. We had just this long conversation yesterday about it, and he just, I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously him wanting to do it is not a reason to do it, but I'm very torn, much more torn than I would think I would be.
I will tell you that he should definitely read John Madden's autobiography, Hey, Wait a Minute, I Wrote a Book, which is great.
Really?
I mean, it's very funny. It was very funny to me when I was like 10.
Okay.
Yeah. Highly recommended.
Good tip.
All right, let's move on. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is brought to you by Bull and Branch. So, Allison, another thing I did while my neighbors were shoveling during the blizzard was I slept. I slept whenever I could during the blizzard because sleep matters to parents. So you should get your sheets from a company that takes sleep as seriously as you do, and that company is Bull and Branch. They've reinvented sheets and bedding with the sole purpose of making your nights more comfortable than ever. At BullandBranch.com, you know you're paying for quality, fair trade certified sheets and not department store overhead. You're getting amazingly luxurious sheets for just a couple $100. Go online to Bull, that's B-O-L-L, like a cotton bowl, and branch.com, and they'll let you try them risk-free for 30 nights. If you don't like them, just return them. It gets even better. Go to bullandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order. Sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, anything you order, plus free shipping. Bullandbranch.com, 20% off with promo code MOMANDDAD. Back to the show.
Earlier this week, the World Health Organization declared the Zika virus an international health emergency. As many as 4 million people could be infected with the virus worldwide, though the vast majority of them will only feel the most minor symptoms and not be in any danger at all. The concern, then, is that the mosquito-borne illness is causing a rise in cases of microcephaly, a rare and extremely serious birth defect in Brazil. Some countries, like El Salvador, have taken the extreme step of telling women not to get pregnant. Here in the States, there are no such warnings and much less danger of infection, but that doesn't mean pregnant women and women planning to become pregnant and their partners aren't nervous nonetheless. Today, Dr. Gay Rodkey, a New York City OBGYN, is joining us on the phone to give us some straight talk on Zika. Hi there, doctor.
Hi there.
So let's say I'm a longtime patient of yours, and I'm hoping to get pregnant this year, and I come to your office and say I'm considering waiting because I'm nervous about Zika. What do you tell me?
Well, actually, if you live in New York, now is a great time to get pregnant. and let me explain. Right now, Zika is present throughout, as you mentioned, Central and South America, as well as the Caribbean. And it is spread by mosquitoes, the Aedes mosquitoes, that are really throughout even the southeastern United States. It's probably only a matter of time until Zika comes here. And if Zika comes here, I would prefer that you had been pregnant and were closer to delivery before it even came within reach of you, if I could.
So you seem more nervous about this than I, or concerned about this than I thought you would. If you were, you know, we have listeners all over the country. If you were talking to listeners that are in, you know, in the Southeast, this is, you think, something for them to go to their doctors and talk about. This is
I don't know how much their doctors, how much going to their doctors to talk about it will, you know, I'm not really sure that if they haven't been in a place where it's known to be when they're pregnant, that there's much to say. Certainly if a woman has been in a place where this is now being spread widely, which is now 28 countries in Central and South America and the Caribbean, I think that if they've been to those countries and if they've had even a mild viral syndrome, it's going to be an opportunity for close follow-up and probably a lot more anxiety during the pregnancy than we would like anybody to have. If people want to know where the virus is and where it's endemic, the CDC's website at cdc.gov is a great source of information. They also have, since this virus is spread by the same mosquitoes that spread dengue and yellow fever, if you look at the articles for dengue, they can show you the distribution of this type of mosquito around the world, actually. So it's unlikely to remain a Central and South American problem.
It's been interesting seeing this story just sort of blow up over the last few weeks. And part of it is, of course, is that there's a very specific suspected results to these infections in pregnant women, and something that can be tracked and that you can take pictures of. But it also does seem to feed a very specific kind of anxiety that people who are having children or thinking about having children feel. And it just reminds me of sort of like a sort of series of scares that you have every couple of years about pollution or sushi or, you know, high tension power lines or whatever. Like, there are always things that people get very nervous about. And so it's useful to me, I think, to hear you, a doctor, taking this seriously. And what role do you play in assuaging or helping your patients deal with these anxieties and help make plans around them?
Sure. Well, I think that we have to discuss the fact that everybody's tolerance for risk is different, and everybody's ascertainment of what is a significant risk is different. I mean, 1 in 5,000 babies in Brazil is not a small number if you multiply it by the number of babies in Brazil. And if it's your baby, it's 100% for you. And the problem is that you can't really reliably diagnose microcephaly until about 20 weeks of pregnancy, when most people are beyond the time when they would consider termination. And by the time you confirm it with a follow-up scan, a couple weeks later, you're up against legal barriers to termination pretty soon. So since we don't have a vaccine, I think we need to talk about the risks and prevention. And we need to deal with the preventable and non-preventable infections. So if I had someone who was not pregnant and contracepting, and they've had a trip to Brazil to meet, you know, their new in-laws planned for 2 years or whatever, certainly there's not a good reason to tell them to cancel that trip. Although, I would remember that right now it's summer in the Southern Hemisphere. It's probably a great time for the mosquitoes. They need water, standing water to breed, but not very much. A bottle cap's enough. So if I had a patient who either really wanted to travel there or was going to travel there no matter what, you know, I would suggest that they should wear clothing that covers them. If you're staying in hotels, stay in the bigger hotels that are going to have screens and air conditioning, and don't sit out for long periods in the evening when the mosquitoes are more active. I think a lot of control is going to come down to mosquito control, because it will undoubtedly be a while before we have a vaccine for this particular virus. The next thing to do is to kind of put things in context. I mean, look, we can compare this to other viruses that we don't want pregnant women to get that are person-to-person transmitted, things like chickenpox that are very contagious just from, you know, droplet and respiratory transmission. It also carries great risk in the first and second trimester and also can cause microcephaly. Or CMV, which is another virus that can cause microcephaly that probably 25% of the population has evidence of having had CMV at some point. And if a mother gets that in the first trimester, there's about a 30% chance of congenital CMV, and that can lead to a 12 to 18% chance of serious neurological defects that persist.
Are there tests being developed to be able to detect microcephaly earlier? Because the conversations I've had with friends of mine who are considering getting pregnant and are concerned about this are really largely about if I could know earlier, like when my state would allow me to still get an abortion, I wouldn't be as frightened.
Well, the problem is that in the first trimester, you pretty much establish dates by the size of the baby's head, because there's much less differential between the size of a baby that's going to be a 6-pound baby and the size of a baby that's going to be a 10-pound baby when they're like 6 to 8 weeks of gestation. So really, growth is usually measured as a rate of increase. And so you measure it, you know, you would be measuring the head size growing as you were also measuring the abdominal circumference and the length of the thigh bone growing. And it's only when those two curves start to diverge, or where you see a significant difference in the median age that you would predict by a head that size versus the median age you would predict by a thigh bone of that length. It's really only there that you're going to see the difference. And what we don't want to see is people, you know, some babies will be smaller than others. And so what we don't want to see is overreaction and women terminating wanted pregnancies because one single measurement was on the lower end of normal. Because after all, plus or minus 2 standard deviations of the means is normal. We all know people who are just constitutionally smaller than each other. So the problem we have is how much worry versus how much is prudent and how much is unnecessary.
How, as a doctor, how do you balance giving people this kind of important information for something that you clearly view as serious and stopping them from obsessing about it, from over-worrying, from being so overcome by anxiety that it ends up being counterproductive?
Well, I think that some patients are more anxious than others. And I usually tell my patients that we try to prevent the things we can prevent. We try to do our due diligence and do the observations that will reassure us that things are going well. And then if they're not going well, then our job is to find the very best people to figure out what is going wrong and what the implications are in a timely fashion so that they have options open. So I think that, you know, look, no one can ever tell anyone their baby is 100% going to be fine. Even for patients who come in and have, they say, a 1 in 2,000 risk of a chromosomal abnormality, they have a 1 in 2,000 risk. And even if you did an amniocentesis to rule out that 1 in 2,000 risk of all the things we can check for, there's still a background risk of about 1 in 500 babies will have something you could not check for before the baby's born. So, you know, I think that you have to concentrate on the 499. You have to do the things that you can do, like wearing protective clothing, using insecticides, staying in good hotels, not going trekking through the swamp. You have to do the things you can do to minimize your risk so that you feel you've done what you can do. And then you have to access good people if you develop symptoms of a viral infection or an infection of any kind in pregnancy, anything that involves fever, rash, joint pain, muscle pain, or significant illness. You need to be seen because those are also symptoms of things like flu, which in a normal person are not that dangerous, but pregnant women have higher rates of both getting the flu and dying of flu than other people do. So it doesn't mean that you have to live in a cloistered environment, but it does mean you have to be careful and take what precautions you can. Minimize your risks.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Rocky. This is really useful. I think that people will be really interested to hear this.
I hope it helps put it in perspective and yet doesn't cloister women unnecessarily.
It was great. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Mom and Dad is also brought to you by Club W, a new wine club that makes finding and obtaining and drinking good wine really easy. Avoid the nightmare that is picking out wine from a wine shop. Club W sends wine directly to your door. Club W's easy 6-question quiz figures out your palate, so every bottle you receive is tailored to your taste. The quiz is actually very fun. I took it today. It asks you about what kind of coffee you like and your level of citrus love and how salty you like your food. It makes you really think. Club W works directly with vineyards to cut out the middlemen, which saves you money. Club W even offers a no-risk guarantee that you'll love what they send you. And right now, Club W is offering our listeners 50% off your first order when you go to clubw.com/momanddad. When you go to that URL, there's actually a message that says, Dan and Allison are buying your first bottle of wine. So please, really.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I was so pleased.
I hope all our listeners are cheap dates.
I was going to say make it a good one.
Yeah.
Just go to clubw.com/momanddad to get 50% off of your first order today. Okay, on to our listener call.
Each week we answer a call from one of you, our beloved listeners. If you have a question you want Allison and I to argue about, leave us a voicemail at 424-255-7833. That's 424-255-RUDE, or what Allison is to me when she razzes me about postponing the show. This week's question comes from listener Joe. Take it away, Joe.
My question was, what do you do when trying to dispel society norms about girls? I have a daughter, and it really bothers me when people say, well, you better get a gun soon, because you know those guys are going to be coming for her, and you got to fight them off. I prefer to think that I can have my daughter learn self-defense and defend herself, but I'm really tired of just agreeing or not agreeing, and I don't ever know what to do when someone says that. So if you could help me out, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
I suggest funny jokes. Got any?
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead, Dan. You have the daughters.
Well, I have two thoughts about this, Joe. Yes, funny jokes are one way to do it. Like, just like laughing it off, making it clear through the joke that you're not, that it's not that big of a deal is one way to sort of glide through that social situation. You know, that's what I often end up doing. I generally find that the people who say this to me about my daughters are almost always older. It's not worth like making a big deal out of it. So I sort of just nod and smile. And then I try and spend the other 99.9% of my time with my daughters, reinforcing that they are independent human beings who will grow up to, you know, make their own decisions. But I would also suggest that there is like a slight weirdness to your question, Joe. When you say, oh, well, I'm going to teach them self-defense so they can defend themselves. It strikes me that when you pose the issue in that way, I worry that you are kind of like buying into the same gender assumptions that those yahoos who say those dumb things to you are. Like, you're taking it as a given that your daughters will eventually be beset by rabid teenage boys who just want to get in her pants, and the only solution will be like a gun or her taking Taekwondo or something. But it seems to me that it's just as likely that when our daughters, Joe, are teenagers, they're going to want to get into other people's pants too. That's just the way teenagers are. So, like, I do think it's worth thinking not only about your response to them, but also reminding yourself that this doesn't have to be the way that you think about your kids either. That just because they say these dumb things does not mean you have to think in that same way.
I also think you can answer them. When I said funny jokes, I meant like jokes that would make the person who said that to you feel dumb and make it clear that like you did not agree with those dumb old preconceived notions about gender. But also, you know, you can say, you could answer earnestly and just say like, oh, I trust my daughters. They're smart girls. I mean, yeah. I don't think it needs to be more than that. And then you should trust your daughter, raise them to be smart girls.
Yeah. Or you could be like, haha, I hope you lock up your sons because when she's a teenager, she'll want to have sex with them. Don't say that.
Dinner party over.
All right. Thank you, Joe. And remember, if you have a question you want to ask us, give us a call at 424-255-7833.
Today's show is also brought to you by The Terrible Two Get Worse, the hilarious sequel to The Terrible Two, which spent over 10 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Published by Amulet Books, the series is perfect for fans of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series. The author's longtime friends and certified pranksters, Mac Barnett and Jory John, are bent on prankster domination in this new installment. Pranksters Miles and Niles were already pretty devious, but now that they've formed a pranking duo, they're terrible. In The Terrible Two Get Worse, their powers will be tested when their favorite nemesis, Principal Barkin, is replaced by his stern and cunning father, former Principal Barkin. Now Miles and Niles will do just about anything to get their old antagonist back, including pranking alongside him. Check out this great book that shows kids how they can work with their elders to solve problems and, of course, is filled with funny pranks that, say, Dan's kids can inflict on Dan.
They're already trying. Lyra loves this book just as much as she loves the original Terrible 2.
Awesome.
It's very charming. I do not know that it actually teaches you how to collaborate with your elders. It more teaches you how to prank them, but I think that's fine, too.
Well, they could collaborate with your wife to prank
that's
you.
That's true, to prank me. I look forward to them.
Regardless, thanks, Amulet Books. Okay, Dan, what's next?
All right, let's move on to our next segment. Last month, a bunch of familiar faces showed up on a brand new home. Big Bird, The Count, Elmo, Cookie Monster, the whole gang on Sesame Street have moved from public television to premium cable as new episodes are now airing on HBO. Walling off the most acclaimed children's TV program of all time behind a paywall may seem a little bit contrary to the mission of the Sesame Workshop, but it's a move that the show needed to make to survive. Jessica Pressler reported on the move and on the shifting culture over there on Sesame Street for New York Magazine, and she joins us now to discuss. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Welcome. Why on earth did Sesame Street make this move? Why make the move from PBS to HBO?
Yeah, well, I mean, for starters, I want to just say that it wasn't the whole gang that moved over, because you might have noticed that some of the characters that you know from your childhood are not going to be on the show quite as much, if at all, because it turned out that in the past few years, Sesame Street has kind of been falling off in the ratings, and that's because kids have a lot more options, including they can now choose their own programming through tablets and stuff like that. And they are kind of choosing to not watch Sesame Street. And part of that is because, according to people at Sesame Street and their many focus groups, children are confused by the large array of characters and by the kind of more complicated storylines. It's a very talky show. It's pretty sophisticated because it was kind of designed for parents to watch with their children. But now kids are watching a lot of TV on their own, and they're choosing to kind of watch these a little bit simpler shows that are more like Friends, where they have like four characters that you see all of the time.
Right. There's Dora, and there's Boots, and there's Backpack, and there's Benny, and that's it.
Exactly. And now there's really going to be like Big Bird and Cookie Monster and Abby Kadabi and Elmo.
So they made this move to HBO and they're streamlining the show. But was there a financial reason? How does it affect Sesame Street if no one's watching?
Well, the streamlining started before the move to HBO, which I feel like is important to note. HBO really doesn't have a lot of creative input into the show, or at least not yet. It's really new, their move there. The streamlining of the show started kind of because of this change in children's viewing habits. So the move to HBO isn't really like a huge part of that. It was just because people weren't watching Sesame Street the way that they used to.
Why do you guys? I mean, you just explained, I guess, partly why that is, because I guess we all used to sit and watch with our parents, and they explained it. Although I don't really remember watching with my parents.
I think actually, the way it was explained to me is that there were a lot more stay-at-home moms in the early days of Sesame Street. Moms weren't working as much, so they were like around, you know, ironing or whatever, and watching Sesame Street. And that's kind of why the Muppets had this like sophisticated, other layer of adult humor. And Sesame Street had this other layer of adult humor so that it appealed to parents at the same time, because you had a television and it was like your family television. Everybody was watching it. Now, because people have all these different screens, parents just give kids their iPads. I mean, we don't like to admit that we do that, but it happens occasionally.
You talk about in your piece that the, like, sort of what I remember as being the beloved part of Sesame Street, the parodies, or maybe I don't remember that as a child. I know it as an adult. That's one of
the virally popular parodies.
Right. The one in your piece was a parody of Mad Men called
Birdman.
Birdman. Right. Yes. Genius. That they're getting rid of those. But Dan, you said you watched doing fewer of those. Dan, you said you watched a new episode on HBO and they had one and it was bad?
It was really bad. So they had one. They had a parody of Orange is the New Black. It was called Orange is the New Snack. And it was in their healthy eating episode and it was not good. And it was like, it struck me as like the best argument I could think of that indeed the parodies were not good and kids wouldn't get them at all. Because there's no way that a kid would watch this and be entertained or interested in any way, shape, or form.
Or maybe they've dumbed it down and made it less sophisticated now.
It was really dumbed down, yes. As you were reporting, Jessica, what did you hear from people inside Sesame Street about how they feel about this? I have to assume they were proud of being a sophisticated show with, like, jokes that parents could get, too. Are they annoyed by these changes?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a kind of a battle going on, or there was a battle, a very genteel Sesame Street-like battle going on between the old guard of Sesame Street, who believes that Sesame Street, this is what they are. They're this kind of multi-layered, kind of more sophisticated program. And the kind of new people who are mostly from Nickelodeon, who really just want to appeal to children, which is itself a noble goal and not unreasonable considering that it's a children's show. But there's definitely like kind of some passive-aggressive arguing, I think, going on. And I think that the season that you saw on HBO right now is kind of a product of that, which might be why there was like a bad parody as opposed to no parody. Like it was kind of made by these two forces, these people who wanted it to exist and these people who didn't want it to exist. And you could see how that would be a result of something like that.
So we're talking about the show as though it's, like, you know, super sophisticated. But one of the goals of the show was to teach kids, like, very fundamental ABCs and math, right? Is that still, like, does the new guard care about that? Or is that not part of the mission anymore?
No, that is a part of the mission for sure. I mean, what's really interesting about Sesame Street is that it has changed all throughout its history. It started out being for kids, you know, who were 5 years old, and they were learning letters and numbers and things like that. And as it's aged and parents started going off to work more when their kids were younger, the age of the viewership got a lot younger. So now it's like 2-year-olds watching it. So it's kind of more geared towards younger children now. And the themes of it have changed, too. Like Sonia Manzano, who played Maria, she's Maria to me, told me that in recent years, like, it's mainly been about, like, assuaging children's anxiety. That's been, like, a huge theme of the show because that's the kind of stuff that kids want from programming now. It's not even so much learning letters and numbers. They're younger. They just want to be, like, calmed down from the complexity of the world.
That's so interesting. Is that what kids want or is that what parents want? Yeah, it's really sad.
Yeah, well, I think that anxiety is a big problem with kids these days. So that's a kind of how it's developed is to kind of help them with that.
In terms of the original mission, which was, you know, to basically to help lessen the achievement gap, really, in like poor kids and wealthy kids with more resources, is that like how do they talk about that now?
That is really interesting. So like, yeah, well, the mission is definitely still to teach kids things like healthy eating, you know, letters, numbers, all of the like basic life skills. And because the episodes are still airing on PBS, albeit 9 months later, they're still going to their original audience, ostensibly, hopefully. There's just a kind of a big delay there.
Yeah.
But they still talk about that very much as a mission of the workshop in general. And the workshop does other stuff, too. Like, they do a lot of special programming that we don't see. Like, they produce entire specials for kids whose parents are in prison, for kids whose parents are dying. There's a whole other level of stuff that they do with the Muppets.
And they'll continue to do that stuff.
And they'll continue to do that stuff.
I mean, it's interesting the various ways they're branching out. Allison, you sent me this piece about they just launched like a venture arm to invest in startups that help kids, especially like mobile and tablet startups as a way of finding different ways into that market, which seems really smart. But it still sort of seems like the overarching question on this is, And I want to know, Jessica, what you think. Like 20 years from now, will kids be watching Sesame Street? Is Sesame Street going to exist, or is something that is designed to be smarter than other children's programs, no matter how much they dumb it down, just doomed no matter what?
I don't know. I mean, I think Sesame Street will exist. You can't really deny the power of Elmo. Elmo will exist, and children will love him forever, I think, and if he wants them to learn things. And kids want to learn things, so I think that it will exist. And in some ways, even though it's sad because we're losing a lot of the things that we like about Sesame Street, it's probably actually good that these changes are happening, because I noticed that my son, who's 2.5, he totally has lost interest in Sesame Street. He's been all about Daniel Tiger. It's been way too long. It's too talky. Like, Tina Fey was on, like, being Mother Goose, and I thought it was really great. And he had, like, no interest because it was just going on and on forever. So I think, like, they do have to kind of keep up with how kids are thinking and how they're developing now, which is different than in the past.
My kids also, I couldn't get any of them to watch Sesame Street at all. We had like a brief phase with the Muppets, but no Sesame Street. They really didn't like it. But I'm perplexed by that, because I don't really, like, yes, gadgets change and technology changes, but like, I don't really, kids, I find it hard to believe that kids change that drastically.
Well, it was also
so much more.
There's so much more. It was like we had that, and we had like the electric company.
But it's a lot of crap. I mean, I was trying to think, like, what are the descendants of Sesame Street? Like, what could we at least point to and think, okay, our kids aren't going to watch Sesame Street, but they'll watch this. And this is also, like, good and, you know, more than just mindless. Yeah, and I can't think of anything.
No.
Can you, Dan?
There isn't that much that is made specifically in this mode that's, like, meant to be fun and engaging but quiet and also a little bit intellectual. Like, it says, one of the things you mentioned in your piece, Jessica, that I loved was Sesame Street has always had these sort of highbrow aspirations, you know, as they say, that's the show where they'll be like, well, can we get Itzhak Perlman? And I love that about the show. And there isn't a show that does that anymore. I mean, there's like Yo Gabba Gabba, which has like hipster celebrities on it sometimes. But that's clearly not the same thing. But I am struck, though, too, by what you say about Elmo, because one thing that I had forgotten until I was reading about this more is that Elmo wasn't around when we were kids. Elmo was not a character who existed when we were kids. And when Elmo became incredibly popular in the 90s, there was this wave of backlash, not unlike the kinds of concerns we're talking about now, from parents who had once loved Sesame Street, who thought Elmo was stupid and appealed too much to little kids and, like, you know, abandoned the mission of Sesame Street to educate. But he is now a beloved part of the show and does his part to make the show great and to make the show educational. And I sort of feel like in the same way, 20 years from now, people might look back on this era and be like, oh, well, this is when it became for younger kids, but it still remained good.
Right. Yeah. When I kind of dug into the history of Sesame Street, the very original mission statement said that it was an evolving piece of programming and it was going to evolve with the needs of children and with the needs of communities. So, I mean, hopefully it will keep that. But the other thing that was interesting is that Jim Henson, his original vision was part of it was, you know, wanting it to help kids become better people, not just helping them learn the alphabet, but to kind of become good people. And I don't know if that is so much. I mean, I don't think that it's encouraging them to become sociopaths, but I don't know. I didn't really hear that talked about so much, and that's kind of interesting.
And I don't think we look to our TV for that anymore. I mean, we look to the TV to babysit our kids,
right? Now, I will say one last thing, which is that the Orange is the New Black parody was bad, but it did include a Muppet who was clearly based on Laverne Cox, who I assume is now the first officially transgender Muppet, which I thought was great. That's delightful.
That is pretty delightful.
All right. So, listeners, tell us what you think. I really want to know, do you watch Sesame Street? Do your kids watch Sesame Street? Do you like this new, shorter, streamlined version without Elmo's world and without other things you might remember? Go to Facebook.com/momanddadarefighting and let us know. All right. Jessica's story is called What Will HBO's Sesame Street Look Like? It's in New York Magazine. It's really great. We'll post a link on our Facebook page. Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks, Dan.
All right, before we move on to recommendations, there's one other piece of business we want to mention. Panoply has a brand new podcast series launching this week, which we think you will enjoy. It is really attuned to the needs of parents. It is called Quiet, The Power of Introverts. It's hosted by Susan Cain, the bestselling author of the book Quiet. The whole podcast series is about parenting and teaching introverted children. The series speaks to parents, to teachers, and to kids, and gives parents great tips on how they can help their quiet kids thrive. Once again, it's called Quiet, The Power of Introverts with Susan Cain. It launches this Thursday, the same day our show goes live, and you can subscribe and hear a sneak peek of the show at iTunes.com/quiet.
I'm incredibly interested in listening to the show, actually. I do not have any quiet children, but I would love to hear what that... No, I'm serious, though. That's like a part of parenting I hadn't really thought about, and I want to know more.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. I will definitely listen in. All right, recommendations. Allison, what do you got?
We have been reading an old book about the Greek gods and myths to the boys, and they're totally transfixed. And I'm pretty transfixed, too. I think this is a classic book, according to Slate Slack. This is a classic book that my parents didn't read to me when I was young. Mom, why didn't you read this to me when I was young? I'm sure there are many great books about the Greek gods, but I'm going to recommend this one, which is Dallaire's Book of Greek Myths.
Yes, that is the book of Greek myths.
Somebody bought it for us. Okay, well, it's full of beautiful illustrations and great storytelling. And here's my corny joke. Ready? I can't say it without introducing it. Greek god only know how many names I mispronounced while reading this book.
I would also recommend, if your kids love that, Dallaire's Book of Nordic Myths.
Ah, okay, good to know. We'll move on to that one. Also, two quick additional recommendations. One, a shout out to sitting at the bar when you go out to dinner alone with one of your children. I just did this with Harry, and we had like the best dinner conversation. And I really think it was something about the seating, about the bar, or something like more easier for him to talk to me in that setting. So recommend that. And then you guys have to watch the OJ miniseries on FX. This has nothing to do with parenting, although there are great Kardashian family scenes. But if you're listening to the show, you are likely our generation, which means you watch the whole OJ saga unfold in real time. And I think you will love this show.
Those are great recommendations.
Thank you. What do you have?
I'm also recommending a TV show. I'm recommending Project Runway Junior. Not only because it is a fun show that my kids completely love, not only because it has encouraged them to design a bunch of outfits. I mean, by design outfits, I mean they draw pictures on paper of clothes they already own, and then they go put those clothes on in weird combinations, and then they like strut around the house modeling them. Not only because it got Harper more interested in sewing, which she now really is into, but also, this surprised me a little bit. I didn't think of this ahead of time, but it is a show that has introduced them to a lot of teenagers who are smart and ambitious and multi-ethnic and non-traditional gender conforming. It is sort of like the diverse, cool school that they would have been able to go to if we had not left New York. But the show is super entertaining, and kids really love it. And I think you will love it, too, if you watch it with your kids.
That's a good one.
All right, that's our show. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is taped before a live studio audience. Just kidding. But remember that you can come be our live studio audience in Brooklyn on February 18th. Go to slate.com/live. Please like us on Facebook so that Allison thinks you really actually like her. Facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. And email us with ideas for topics and guests at momanddad@slate.com. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is part of the Panoply Network. To listen to our other great shows, go to iTunes.com/panoply. Thanks to our producer, Ann Hepperman, and to our intern, Shiva Bayat. Thanks to Steve Lichtai, the managing producer of Slate Podcasts, and Andy Bowers, the chief creative officer of Panoply. Thanks to our guests, Jessica Pressler, Gabe Roth, and Dr. Gay Rodkey. Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for listening.
During this presidential election season, how can you shine when the conversation turns to politics? By listening to the Panoply Network's full lineup of political podcasts. There's Podcast for America with MSNBC's Alex Wagner, the campaign history show Whistlestop with John Dickerson, The Weeds, a deep dive into policy with Vox's Ezra Klein, and the granddaddy of political podcasts, Slate's Political Gabfest.